What have I learned about power and peace? Power really lies in communication. My feeling is that if more was made public about how people, particularly women, have stopped wars in countries experiencing acute violence, raging violence, what they achieve on absolutely minimal budgets to stop those conflicts, it would begin to make an impact. It will need a huge promotion and communications campaign.
As a CIA officer in Iraq during the war, I lived in a world where power meant weapons, money, and force. And yet, I kept encountering a deeper power. Policies changed, governments shifted, military plans often failed, but connection to each other, to the earth, and to something larger than ourselves kept proving more powerful than violence and destruction. I'm Janessa Gans Wilder, and this is Peace is Power, a podcast exploring how peace will change your life and our world. Each week, I speak with leaders, artists, activists, and spiritual thinkers around one core question. What if true power is not domination, but connection? Welcome to Peace is Power.
Hi, friends. Today I'm bringing you someone I consider to be one of the great elders of the peace movement. Dr. Cilla Elworthy is 82, a three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and one of the most quietly powerful forces for peace today. She founded the Oxford Research Group in 1982 to create dialogue between nuclear weapons decision makers and their critics during the Cold War. She founded Peace Direct, which supports local peace builders in conflict zones worldwide. She was an advisor to Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Peter Gabriel, and Richard Branson in founding the Elders. And she's written 13 books. When I moved to Paris this year, I packed three books: a collection of poetry by my favorite Irish poet, John O'Donohue, the Bible, and Cilla's book, The Business Plan for Peace. That should tell you something about what her work means to me. I knew she was brilliant, but I didn't expect such lightness in our conversation. With a lifetime of witnessing war and loss, she's not depressed or exhausted. She sees possibilities. She has hope. And she told me her heart has never once failed to give her the right answer. In this conversation, we talk about why war is a trillion-dollar industry, while peace is funded by scraps. What happened in Liberia when women decided enough was enough? What happens when you stop fighting the tides and start listening to your heart? And why every single one of us, whatever our background, whatever mistakes we've made, has a quiet fire burning inside that this moment in history is calling on us to use? Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Cilla Elworthy. So, Cilla, it is such an honor to be with you. And I really just want to honor the powerful lineage of women like you who are helping to make peace a practical force in the world. And I want you to know I brought three books with me for this year in Paris. They are a book of poetry by the Irish poet John O'Donohue, the Bible, and your book, Business Plan for Peace. So this probably tells you how much I value your contribution, not only the spiritual longing for peace, but the practical, disciplined case for funding it, building it, and making it real. So I want to get into all that, but before, I'd love to just ask you a personal question. And that I wanted to ask, how are you? How are you feeling? But I know that's very broad and general. So just what is breaking your heart at the moment? And also what is giving you courage, would you say?
doesn't actually break my heart anymore, because my heart has been so broken in the past by war and all my experiences in places very similar to what you've been in Africa mainly, but in many other places. So now that I'm 82, I spend a lot of time really contemplating deeply on what are the most effective ways to stop war. And I'm glad that that's what we're talking about today. And I do that with a number of colleagues, but also with a lot of silent internal inquiry. That's where wisdom is to be found, not in my mind, but in my heart. So many people are depressed at the moment. I'm not depressed. I see lots of possibilities. And because I deal with a lot of very able peace builders every day, I'm so encouraged by their work. It's amazing.
Yes. It's like if they don't give up, then how can we? You know, if they're in the thick of it and living this day to day and showing up with courage and open hearts, then that's our example and our model. So I have been seized, Scylla, for a year, as I imagine you have been, with this question for years. And it is, why is war a $1 trillion industry? And yet everyone I know in the peacebuilding field are paupers. When we say what we want is peace, and yet we're investing in the opposite. You know, every beauty pageant, world peace, you know, we all want that, but we're investing in war, we're funding war. Why do you think that is? And I know you have a plan to do otherwise, but what do you think, how did we so miss the boat that we would fund the opposite thing that we want?
I have to be very confrontational about this, because I do believe it's because we have many of the decisions being made in the ministries all over the world are being made by men. And as soon as more women get involved, things begin to change. But I came from a military family. I've got four brothers, and I know the way they think. And it's not their fault. They just got brought up like that. They brought up thinking war was glamorous, and some of them who did actually learn that war is not at all glamorous. And so I do believe it's a masculine-dominated business, and the masculine mind honors what money can be made, whatever they're doing. And an enormous amount of money can be made funding war by all means we know. So I do feel that one of the main problems is that we don't have enough women in the decision-making process, and those that are there, bless them, have a very hard uphill job. And many of them honestly have abandoned what most women would be wanting to say if they were having this conversation with you now. So we're stuck in a very male-dominated world, and there are enormous incentives for any men to get involved in war. I do believe that's part of the problem, and I've got some examples for you which will demonstrate what happens when women take over.
I would love to hear those examples. I do want to put in the plug right now for this book. I wish that every leader had it on his or her bedside reading table, because it's just so simple and practical and clear that there is a business plan for peace. It's not only the moral choice, but it is less costly, it's more strategic, it's more effective. All these things, I have loved it and I've learned so much through it, Scylla. What has been the reaction that you found to this book? And why isn't it on the front page of every newspaper?
I've written 13 books, I think, and I just haven't had the time or devoted the time, because I've been doing a lot else, to promote them. And now that I'm semi-retired, I think it's time to do a bit more work on lifting the profile, or even doing a new version. I mean, it's easy to do. And getting it into some of the places that it needs to go, because I've been so busy in the kind of work that you know about, that I haven't devoted time to promoting a book or any of the books. And so that's true of, I think, 12 books that I've written. They just haven't been, you know, put in the right hands.
And now is the time, I feel, Zilla, because we are moving as a world, as you know, in the opposite direction. I mean, we're actually increasing our military spending, if that's even possible. Of course, last year was the highest on record. But even so, even Canada said they're going to double their defense budget by the end of 2030. Obviously, Europe now, with Trump saying that they're not pulling their full weight in regards to NATO, they're having to amp up. So in a way, it's like we're seeing this resurgence. I mean, we're seeing it practically in measurable ways like military spending, but also this resurgence of a might makes right worldview, of a power over, of a force is the only power that there is. These are the iron laws that have stood throughout time. That's what Stephen Miller, one of Trump's advisors, said. And what do you make of this resurgence? And then what can we effectively do about it?
Well, I think it's ignorance. When we investigate the stories of what people, particularly women, do in countries experiencing acute violence, raging violence, what they achieve on absolutely minimal budgets to stop those conflicts. So if your aim is to stop conflicts, not to make a fortune out of them.
Or cause them,
yeah. Or increase your standing amongst your fellows. Then, of course, we have wars, but military budgets are very persuasive and go down well with voters and so forth. So my feeling is that if more was made public about how and at what minimal cost women particularly have stopped wars, and I've got wonderful, wonderful examples, it would begin to make an impact. It will need a huge promotion and communications campaign.
That's exactly what Satish Kumar said a few weeks ago. He said it should be like Coca-Cola. Peace should be on every billboard, that we have a communications problem and that we have not effectively made the case to a largely ignorant public who has just either steeped in the culture of violence or steeped in this is the only way to promote this other narrative, promote this other way.
Exactly.
Okay, so I know you have some examples that you said you'd love to share about whether it's women's effectiveness or...
Well, I think your first question was, what have I learned about power and peace? So let me come to that one. Power really lies in communication. And if you examine, for example, what happened in Liberia, the civil war had been raging for 14 years. Over 200,000 people had been killed. And one in three people were displaced, and rape was used as a weapon for war. Utter chaos and misery. Women of Liberia organized a mass action for peace, and it started in 2003. They issued a statement of intent. In the past, we were silent. I'm just reading it now. But after being killed, raped, dehumanized, and infected with diseases, and watching our children and our families destroyed, war has taught us that the future lies in saying no to violence and yes to peace. We will not relent until peace prevails. Thousands of local women prayed and sang in a fish market daily for months. A delegation of Liberian women then went to apply pressure on the warring factions themselves during the peace process that was held in Ghana. 200 women surrounded the room, dressed in white, dominating the conversation. Anytime the negotiators tried to leave without reaching a settlement, the women threatened to take off all their clothes. The men tried to jump out of the windows to escape, but the women blocked all the doors and windows and prevented anyone from leaving until the peace talks made a resolution. Then they staged a sit-in outside the presidential palace, and then brought about an agreement with the president on the stalled peace talks. So these women were able to achieve peace in Liberia after a 14-year civil war, and it later helped to bring power to the country's first female head of state, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. When she came into office, the first thing she did was to make women's rights one of her priorities. There's a brilliant book that's been written and a documentary film called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. So I believe that this is to answer one of your other questions, that you noticed that I often speak of the inner work required to transform conflict. How can we now strengthen our heart and our courage in this climate at the moment of domination and the wish to prevail? You know, and I know, that this work requires immense determination, deep imagination, and endless persistence. But what I detect in imagining and examining what works are the other extraordinary qualities that appear to be essential for effectiveness in peace building. The outstanding women in all my studies don't appear to conform to any of the norms that might apply to men in conflict situations. But they do appear to have distinct qualities that may account for their determination, their vigor, their courage, and their effectiveness. And I looked at these qualities, and they include vigor. They're very vigorous, these women. They're full of energy. Listening. It's a key to any peace building, is listening. We all think we're good listeners, but very few of us are. And there's a skill in it, because you understand another person that you don't like. Key to any kind of communication. Resilience, of course, their ability to bounce back when their careful planning is blocked. Sisterhood, the comfort of being able to rely on other women sticking their necks out. And self-belief. So, to make good of their extraordinary experiences in all the stories I've collected, I would like to encourage us all and to build programs to really think hard about what we can learn from this. What are the skills of those who oppose war most effectively? I could probably list some of them. How could this information be used to encourage and educate future generations? Because when I bring this knowledge into schools, the kids jump at it.
And they're not being taught these skills in schools. They're taught debate. They're taught mastery of information and regurgitation of that information. But self-knowledge or courage or vigor or moral clarity.
Or listening.
Yeah, or listening.
Listening gets you further in a peace talk than anything else. So it's fine, but women do still get sidelined in the efforts to stop war. And that's the key thing I think we need to attend to raise the profile of some of our leading women who have been able to make an impact. And their stories are very deeply inspiring. So that's one of the ways. But it's not only a question of women. It also requires something that you've done a lot of in your career, and I've done a lot of, which is actually sitting down with men, male leaders, particularly people who've risen to very high positions in the military, and talking to them. Because when one gets in a quiet environment where it's not public, there's often a very great deal that they want to talk about and hear from us. And so, as you know, I spent a lot of my career arranging those quiet meetings with military leaders. And it's been very encouraging. It doesn't always pull off a big change because they get alarmed when they propose the kind of thing that they've talked to me about. But I do believe that it's not wasted energy to have long conversations, deep conversations, with military leaders of all the countries involved. And I think we could train and organize and send articulate, able women and men to have these conversations with military leaders in the key nations that are at war at the moment.
Hey, listeners, if you're wanting to go deeper in your peacebuilding journey, come visit us at euphrates.org. Euphrates Institute is the organization I founded after my time serving in Iraq during the war. We offer courses, resources, and a global community of peace builders from more than 60 countries who are learning how to practice peace within and without. You can learn more at euphrates.org.
You know, so I don't know if you've found this, but usually I've found folks in the military who are, it's not abstract for them. They're serving, they're putting their lives on the line. They are demonstrating tremendous amount of courage and willingness to sacrifice themselves. And they are much more open and aware of this need for peace because it most directly affects them than, let's say, you know, the ones who are sitting apart in their oval offices or positions of leadership who don't have skin in the game, or the ones who are profiting from it, of course, you know, financially, or leaders making decisions. But it's interesting. And then, of course, we know so many veterans who have served become the biggest advocates and the staunchest advocates for peace. And even George Washington, after the Revolutionary War, became seized with this idea of a peace-building academy. And then we know it was General Eisenhower who led the Allied forces in World War II, who was the one who warned of this concept of a military-industrial complex to begin with, and that it would be felt in every city, every community in the U.S., spiritually, as well as financially and politically. So it's interesting to think of finding common cause, if we're each bridge builders of peace, finding common cause that we might think we may disagree with, but that actually we have much common ground to build on.
I think that's without question. It does take time, organization, and contacts, but I would be very much inclined to training quite a large cohort of people to initiate these kind of conversations. They are well worthwhile, but you have to have a certain type of courage and a certain type of impudence to raise some of these issues. But it's always been worthwhile.
What would you say, Scylla, and the many women that you have worked with and seen, what is sort of an obstacle that has come up again and again for you that you've seen in them? Is it that we, you know, is it a lack of self-confidence, of courage, or just practical, like lack of contacts, or we're so busy with our lives that it's hard to coordinate and organize outside of our day-to-day, keeping the family and keeping the home going? Or what would you say is an impediment to leadership for women?
There are all those things, and they're well known. So it's not something I would go into in depth, because, you know, there are many people who study it, but I don't. But I do know that those women I've trained and worked with, alongside the men who've been brilliant, do have the courage to make an appointment and go and see and talk to those who have the reins of power. And that takes courage. And it's not everybody who is ready to do that or able. So obviously, there are lots of things that tie women to their kitchen or their children and so on, and I'm absolutely in favor of the work of women. But we need now a much larger cohort of highly trained people who know how to put these points in ways that will get across. So yes, there are lots of people who just can't make the time or don't make the time to do that. But if it were possible to gather the first, say, 50 people who'd done some study, as you've done, who've found out the magnitude of the problem and realize it, and enable them to draft what they really want to say and then go to the right people and deliver that. And if that could be done, first of all, with, say, 20 and then 50 and then 200, inspiring younger people, I think it would be very effective.
And so when you say getting them highly trained, do you mean teaching skills like deep listening, like effective advocacy or movement building? Or what do you see as the needs right now for training?
Oh, well, it's a big subject, but I could show you some of the work we've done on designing training for people to be able to intervene and have the resilience to continue the persuasion even when they're laughed at. Because, you know, we've all been laughed at for saying that peace is possible. And it needs courage. It needs a lot of courage. It needs a lot of heart. You've often mentioned the heart. And I have come to realize that if, for example, I'm put in a difficult spot and I don't know what to say, and I ask my heart always knows the answer. So it's that moment of quiet to just consult my heart in a fraction of a second, and up it comes the most brilliant response. So the heart is a truth teller. It never, ever fails to tell me the truth. And it's got a powerful way with words.
Certainly does. Feeling your heart come through, Scylla, there's such a depth and a care. And it's interesting that that could ever be seen as weak or passive. Like, it is that source of, well, and it's a source of courage, you know. Courage comes from cœur, from the heart.
It does. And it's an engine. And we need to nourish that engine. But once it gets going, it's very, very powerful. Once it's given a voice to speak through, and you have that voice, I have that voice, many of us do.
Do you have a practice, Scylla, that you do on a daily basis, or, you know, a personal, we call them in Euphrates, personal peace practices? And yeah, would you be willing to share a practice that you do that helps you be grounded and equipped in this struggle for peace?
I've been trained by some wonderful teachers of reflection and contemplation, including Thich Nhat Hanh. And where I am at the moment is to spend, my practice is to spend some time just settling, moving from this, which is busy, steadily down my body to my heart, and then simply listening to my heart and see what it has to say. Because my heart will probably have either a nudge or a suggestion or a piece of information that I don't have. And it comes up with it. And it takes a bit of quiet and silence. And as you know, I live in the countryside, and it often happens on a walk in the countryside with my husband that these sort of insights come up of what to do next or what to say to whom. And it's often a natural environment that helps that. So I do a lot of gardening and working with plants. And seeing them grow is enormously encouraging, because it means any of us can grow whatever age we are.
Nature, as I like to say, is my church. It's just a place where I can feel so connected and realize there's so much going on that I am not in charge of. I don't decide when the leaves should fall or when this thing should. We're not even responsible for life. It just grows of itself. We're just one little part in that hole. And somehow just stepping outside helps me remember that. I'm not responsible, and I'm allowing. And so I want to tie this to, sometimes there's an energy in this work, you know, that's similar to, it's a struggle, or it's a fight for peace, or it's a pushing, even the words we give to activism and protest, and it's a pushing energy. And I have to, well, I struggle with that, because then there's also the allowing energy, the surrendering and the grounding energy. But that can be labeled by some people as giving up or as surrender. And it's interesting how it's not either one. It's like we need to have that fierce urgency of now and the courage and the fight, quote unquote, but through a different kind of energy. I know I did not put this question to you ahead of time in any way. I'm just wondering how you balance that push and pull energy, and or if you've just been able to reconcile it. What does that look like for you?
I don't feel it as a push and pull energy. I believe that we need various means of expressing what we learn doing this work. And one of those means, as you know, is to write it down. Another is to respond to any invitations to speak publicly about what we know and what we feel, and not to hesitate to talk about meditation and contemplation and the power of the heart, because often it rings a real bell with people. And so you were talking about a push and pull. I don't feel that. I feel, and it's because I've lived a long time, that I kind of ride with the tides in my life and try not to fight them. You know, if there's a disappointment or a disaster, or there's a great deal of encouragement, just to ride the waves. And the heart will always support us to do that. So it's relying on the messages from inside ourselves, given our life history, and not to interfere with what wants to happen. Sometimes it doesn't look very pretty, but we have to respond to it. And the key thing is courage, as you've said. The heart provides us. When the mind sort of fails and says, oh no, I couldn't possibly do that, what we have to do is just sit in front of a mirror and open our mouth and speak and practice speaking and speak. And that's how we manage to say what seems impossible to people who don't want to hear it.
Do you think everyone, Scylla, is equipped to do that? Can anyone be a peace builder?
Yes, absolutely anyone. It's a question of fire. We have to be fired up. You know that. Anybody you've worked with knows that there is a quiet fire that burns in peace builders. And it's an energy to, when you've been shut up by some bossy generals or whatever, to not take it as personal, just say, oh, they don't know, shame, and get on with it. And in a way, it's almost derived from, I would say sometimes, a military framework. You know, you just pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep going. And being brought up with four big brothers, most two of whom were in the military, probably helped.
Oh my goodness. I don't know if you have a story, maybe it's from even childhood growing up with brothers or from your work, Scylla, where you felt challenged or confronted in that way and you accessed a deeper power within you and what that either felt like or what the result was.
Many, many times. What comes up in my mind is not very conscious because I was only 10 years old when my brother, young brother, was killed in a motor smash. And I was told of his death and it shattered my whole life because I adored him. And it wasn't immediate, the recovery, but I began to, I just developed an understanding with his spirit. And, you know, the message was, my body may not be there, but I'm here. And it's given me strength all the way through because he was in the military and he understood these things. So it's been what could have been an utter tragedy and was, has turned into a source of, you can do it.
And you've felt him walking alongside you. You felt him in this work.
He knows what to do when I don't.
What a beautiful story. And you were 10, like such a formative age to experience not only that grief that could have broken you, it could have jaded you, but to use that as fuel for something so life-giving, such a life-giving force.
Yeah, your question makes me think. That was about when I started to go in this direction.
Oh my goodness.
In 12, 13. And I didn't really know why. And my father certainly didn't understand what I was doing. But my mother did, and my mother encouraged me. And so I've been very, very fortunate to have colleagues and some members of my family who really understand and applaud and like it.
And you know what you're sharing, I feel like we're living, even if we don't have individual stories, many, many, many of us do, of tragedy and grief, we're living in a collective time that is so heavy and hard, whether it's, you know, the overarching crisis of the climate that is this existential, you know, we don't know what our future is or for our children, or the political environments or conflicts or decreasing democracy. I mean, you can just name them, but it is felt as sort of a collective heaviness and a grief. And the story that you shared makes me want to say, you know, how can we also keep our hearts open in the midst of this heaviness, in the midst of this grief and tragedy? And that one, it was a choice, you know, you made that choice to move forward instead of breaking down and to stay with the feeling, with the sadness, and keep your heart open. And it's interesting, and I know you teach this too, but like that these are skills that even in this heavy time, what does that look like to support each other in continuing to care and not shutting down, not turning numb, not tuning it out?
Yeah, you know that well. And we've touched on this question of courage, and the courage comes from the heart. And I believe that as soon as young people or campaigners begin to rely on the heart intelligence inside them, I can't stress that too much, because it's so reliable. It does not lie. And you can consult your heart intelligence at any time when you're stuck, and it will help you. So I don't see the temptation or whatever it is to get depressed or sort of slip back into inaction, because the heart is beating all the time, and it wants to act. It wants to get going. It wants us to be actors in this particular period of history. It's calling on the heart of every one of us to act for what we believe in and what we know needs to happen. And so every heart everywhere, without fail, can contribute. Whatever education they've got, whatever background they've got, however many people they've killed, even, they've got a job to do.
And they have a heart. You know, I hear so many times that, well, what if the folks that you're dealing with on the other side don't have a heart? But they do. And if we're alive, we do.
We do.
How would you recommend someone who is new to this field of peace building, or may not even consider themselves a peace builder, but is just starting to get interested, where to begin on their journey and how to start and how to connect with others through this?
Well, first of all, there's so many really good books about, and I'm sure you have a list that you could publish. That, I mean, there are such absolutely wonderful inspirations. Thich Nhat Hanh is a great leader for me, but it doesn't matter where you draw it from. Just go to and read and draw on some of the masters and wonderful women who have worked on peace issues. And it would be easy to draw up just a list. So that would be the first port of call, to get inspired because of the magnificent things that people have done to stop war. Magnificent. And there's so many of them. So that's I think, where I'd start. It could be that you want to go to college and take a course in peace studies. I'm not totally convinced of that, having done it. I think there may be room for a curriculum that's very lively now to bring young people into this. You've talked to so many, and I have too, and to bring some young people together to just devise a handbook. It could be in all sorts of graphics and all kind of media.
YouTube shorts, or yes, exactly, interactive. And
because the peace studies material that I've looked at recently is a little bit too serious, I think. And what we need is this energy, conviction, and stories of what people can do and what they have done. And there are so many of these stories, and they could be sprinkled all the way through a curriculum. Just talking it through with you and the questions you're asking make me feel that really a brand new training program is needed that would really invite people and have a big catchment. And you and I have both got lots of connections through which it could be spread.
Yes, let's do it, Scylla. I'm ready. Whether it's bite-sized, you know, whether it's even a podcast, you listen to a little bit, okay, you're inspired to take the next step to deepen your learning, then you start to practice it in your family, in your environment, in your community, then you take on bigger, then you connect with others. It just starts like that. So it is just as easy as taking the first step.
And if you explain it as you just did, people would get it.
Well, as you said, it starts with getting inspired. We don't have these models. We don't know that this is effective. So I'm going to get your curated list to put on the show notes, and obviously all of your books. And I'm just so grateful. Thank you for centering the heart, in all of this and being who you are, I can feel your wellspring of love and heart that you're bringing to this, and for not hiding that and just sharing it with us and moving me so deeply. And I know you'll move our listeners. So thank you so much.
My dear, you wouldn't see it and recognize it if you didn't have it. It's exactly what you're talking about and what you're doing in your life. And coming from the background you've had, you know, a military background, it makes it all the more powerful. It's a great credential, and it will be good for the people who need to hear what you have to say who are in the military. So, you know, preparing whatever way you choose to do it or we choose to do it could well be designed, some of it, to land within the military and see what happens.
Hi, friends. I know we've done a practice like this before, but let's do it again on purpose because it's so vital. Scylla mentioned the heart is a truth teller. It never fails. So when she doesn't know what to say or do, she settles, moves her attention down from the busyness of her thoughts, and listens to the heart. And after a lifetime on the front lines of this work, that is still her practice. I think that's a wake-up call for all of us, not just for those of us who are new to this work, but for those of us who have been in it a long time. It's really easy to get caught up and busy and strategic and urgent or reactive. We live in our heads and forget sometimes to drop into the one place that really, truly knows. So here's a peace practice for this week. Find a quiet moment, place your hand on your heart, move your attention downwards from whatever your mind is spinning on, and ask, what do I know from the deepest place within me? Let your heart answer and trust that it will. Scylla said there is a quiet fire that burns in peace builders, and that every heart, everywhere, without fail, can contribute. Every heart can contribute. I'd love it if you would share what comes up for you at contact@peacespower.org. I'll look forward to hearing what your heart has to say. Peace and power to you.
If this show speaks to you, please follow it. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Every follow, review, and share helps more people discover the show and helps spread the power of peace a little further.